Welcome to the But Why podcast, where we explore the human experience through a psychological lens by asking, but why? I'm Dr. Kristen.
And I'm Dr. Laura. And today we're exploring myths of performance and stories of women in sport.
Yes, and to kick off our year, even though we're recording this at the end of 2024, this is our first episode of 2025. So to kick the year off, we have two amazing guests. We have Dr. Amy Whitehead and Jenny Cody. And this is our first time with guests. So hopefully we're relatively organized and relatively not too tangential. But these are the perfect and most interesting first guests we could have, who have a great wide range and kind of like interesting expertise in sport and performance. And they're also amazing advocates for equity, diversity, and inclusion in all sporting environments and beyond. They've collaborated on a number of books and other projects, and we're going to be talking about two of them today. So to kick things off, would you guys mind telling us a bit about yourselves? Who wants to start?
So Jen got married, and she's got two identities. One is Jenny Cody and one is Jenny Carr. So yeah. go on, Jenny Carr.
It's only taken me a year and a half to switch over my surname. My bank accounts are still in my other name.
You know what? I haven't even changed my name from McGinty to Minister in the States, so I also have multiple identities.
Yeah. I feel at home. I think that's an intro already, all those little bits and pieces that I and we are doing. The books definitely have been a really exciting parallel to the work that I've been doing on the ground. So seeing them evolve or getting kind of underway in the first part of the Myths of Sports Coaching, and then all the webinar series and stuff. So yeah, that's nice to be here talking to you guys about them today. And the other pieces, I suppose, are just like working across a whole span of grassroots to elite and professional sport, and the common threads that we see that appear in the books, that appear in our daily conversations that we'll share today, and that different hats that I would have had as a player, a coach developer, sports psychology practice, and an analyst in there as well. So I feel fortunate that I've had the opportunity to do all those things, but with that has come experiences that have been really positive and some not so positive, that hopefully I can influence in my current role with the women's pro game, which is the performance wellbeing lead.
Awesome. Thanks for that.
Jen's being very humble.
I'm sure there's a lot more that I like you can share about that, but I don't want to force you to, so
I'm sure we'll give her a prod throughout the podcast.
Yes, definitely.
I'm we call it a reader in the UK, but people are like, what does that even mean? So our associate professor in sports psychology and coaching at Liverpool John Moores University. I'm also a sport and exercise psychologist, supervisor. So Jen and I met maybe 10 years ago. I'm just kind of guessing there, Jen, but we met through our coach development work. So Jen was a coach developer at UK Coaching, and I do a lot of work with coaches, so to promote reflective practice. So I was doing a CPD session with UK Coaching, and that was the beginning of our beautiful friendship.
Yeah,
and here we are now.
Yeah, it was. And do you know what the hook was? Sorry, just sidetracking the whole intro section. Do you know the the appeal was the fact that at the time it was one of the only pieces of work that was thinking and talking about reflective practice, and that was practical in nature in the delivery. So it's really engaging and helpful, and people were like invested in their own development from what you had facilitated that day, as well as bringing the research to life. So I think that's a thread that still comes through our books, 10 years later, on how can we make the language accessible, the practical guidance or top tips or whatever way it's framed by different authors in each chapter. But yeah, what a cool journey we've been on, eh?
Yeah. And I guess for your listeners, I've got to mention you too, because we work together too. I feel like I'm on a pod right now with my favorite people.
Yeah, same. I think we've already mentioned you, Amy, a couple of times on the podcast. So for those who have listened to other episodes and we randomly mention Amy, this is
the Amy.
This is the Amy.
That's
She's here.
It's interesting you brought up the reflection aspect, because we talk about that all the time on the pod, because, you know, we're not just talking about sport, we're talking about a range of topics, and we always try to make, you know, our listeners reflect on things, and like you said, make it as accessible as possible. And I think that it's not necessarily something that most people do in their daily lives unless they actually are prompted to do that. So I was just wondering, sorry to put you on the spot, any like main hot tips about reflection that you might have for anyone of our listeners?
I mean, go to the guru first, but I'm happy to contribute after she says everything. I'm not going after her.
The way it's so, like, I have to like check myself sometimes, because I was having this conversation yesterday with one of our PhD students, Maxine, and she's now in the academia world. She's come from kind of more an applied world, and she was like, I'm constantly like, I'm really getting to know myself so much more. Because I'm like, through the research and through my practice, I'm always like, I'm being forced to question who I am as a person and how that links to everything I do. And it really made me think that like, we are so fortunate, because we're almost in this bubble where we're challenging each other on a daily basis. And in sports, we all work in sports psychology, so that's part of our job. So I do sometimes take it for granted that, you know, we have these deep conversations about like, oh, I was brought, like me and Laura yesterday was having a social class. I'm from a very working class background, and I think like, so I have to make a point of that, because I'm like, I'm working class, and you know, this, look at how like I'm now in a middle class world, and we like, me and Laura unpicked that a little bit.
Oh, I want to hear more about this conversation.
Well, in terms of advice, I think the one question that I always ask people to ask themselves is like, who am I? And it makes people be really uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I think I asked in a vibe and a prof doc the other day, like, who is, you know, who is Jen or who is Kristen or who is Laura?
What a stressful question to ask that person.
In a Viva? Yes. Sorry. While they have an existential crisis and try and defend their Viva. Nice.
So for anyone who's listening who doesn't know, a Viva is when you're defending your PhD thesis or your doctorate work or whatever like that. Just for a bit of context for people who aren't in our, like we say, bubble. But oh my God, Amy, giving them an existential crisis like Jen said.
Then it's a professional doctorate vibe, and it's a person training to be a sports psychologist. And we ask that question all the time, like, who am I as a practitioner, and how does that align with who am I as a person? But yeah, when the words were coming out of my mouth, I thought, oh, you're being a bit shady there. But that's the same question I ask the coaches that I work with, and it really like makes them think, because I don't think they ever connect themselves as a person with themselves as a coach. And, you know, throughout all the work that we do, it's about how we align our values, how we be authentic. And sometimes people live in these very different bubbles of work, social, you know, family, which is great and really works for some people. But then it's about how do we align some of our values and to be happier and healthier as people. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but
No, I think that's a really good initial question to even just get the ball rolling for things. I think that's actually a really good addition to our first episode about identity and sense of self. Kind of, we got a lot of comments about it just because people don't really think about that, and I think that really adds itself to almost supplement that episode of like, okay, who am I? What's my identity that I'm performing? What's my sense of self? Who am I at that deeper values-based level?
Jen, talk in a minute.
Where do I go with that? Do bridge it into something, please.
Like, if I was to ask like family member that question, for example, I think they'd like really struggle. But I think it's a starting question. Even if they don't have an answer right there and then, hopefully they can ruminate and think about it a little bit more, like, over time.
It just reminds me of, again, Kristen, like that first identity episode we spoke about, and we spoke about like how you have like a bit of a performance identity, And I feel like that's the sort of identity that people might talk about initially. So like, you know, Amy, like you're a triathlete, or like you love bikes, so you might talk about like, can I say bike or bicycles?
I like bike. Name. I like many bike.
I am surrounded by bike.
Literally. But I feel like these are the things that we might think about initially, and then there's that kind of deeper part where you mention like the values and like the beliefs, and actually if I'm not kind of constrained by, say, society and kind of norms, who actually am I like underneath all of that?
Yeah, because we are in a world where people, it's performance. Especially coaches that we work with, they get a bit scared of these questions because they're like, well, what's this got to do with my coaching? But my answer to that is, well, how does who you are appear in the actual activity of coaching? So in terms of the feedback that you give, or how you treat people, or the design of your sessions, because all of that is underpinned by who you are and how you've developed as an individual. And it's the same as how we practice as a psychologist, or how we teach as a lecturer, or how Jen, you know, does her, why does Jen care so deeply about the well-being of footballers? And it'll definitely be because of who she is, how she's been brought up. There's a reason she's in the job she is.
Is that a question you want to answer, Jen? Just chucked at you like
it's the badge. Yeah. It's the badge. Yeah. Just the badge. I'm in it for the badge. I'm in it for the stash, the kit.
Yes.
That's a good question. I think I have to be in the right space to answer those kind of questions.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to have the right people around me. I do visit them or variations of them on a regular basis, and they're really useful tools for development or perspective or keeping me present and grounded. But if I don't do it on the right day, it's a long walk with the dog. Until I find some answer. But if I go back to the question, my answer is a bit more simplistic in the surface, or maybe more of headline, kind of the W's and the H. And I found this from all of the, say, communities of practice, one-to-ones, mentoring around this topic with coaches over the years. They very rarely stop and ask themselves, like, why am I doing this?
But why?
Yeah, but why am I doing this? But where am I doing it? I won't do that. So where are they doing it? When are they doing it? And how are they doing it, et cetera, et cetera. So those kind of things have been really good vehicles, or those words have been really good questions, have been really good vehicles for conversation, for them to realise that they've got into a habit. They only reflect after competition or loss or failure, perceived failure. They're usually doing it on their own. So the reflexivity piece doesn't come into it because, I don't know, maybe they're not vulnerable, or they haven't been encouraged to do that, or they haven't been in a good space. I won't even say necessarily safe in the first instance, just a space that's facilitated really well for them to kind of scratch the surface, to get into a deeper level of sharing, and then the safety building and vulnerability around that. So that's where I went when you asked that question, and that's what's come back over the years from different coaches. Gosh, I'm only doing it here. I'm only doing it. It's sitting in the car having a think to myself. And I think there's a whole other, you know, world there of the layers of thinking beyond the superficial what, into a more productive outcome. So yeah, I think that's where my mind went on that.
I think that's so interesting, because that's definitely not something we've addressed on here. You know, we give people reflective questions at the end. We try to, you know, encourage self-awareness, but we've not really even mentioned how the environment can really facilitate that reflection. So like you said, if it's a bad day, maybe let's not reflect on XYZ because it might turn into rumination. Or just letting people know that it's actually possible to reflect in a group setting. There's, you know, reflecting on your own in your car is one thing, but if you're bouncing ideas off of somebody, you know, in a really structured or productive way, that's also a form of reflection. So I think that's a really good thing to introduce to people as well. Did you have any thoughts, Laura?
Did I have any thoughts? No, I think just that it's interesting, I suppose. Yes, you can ask questions, but it is somewhat like what, like you say, what we do with them. Mm-hmm. And if people are in kind of the right space to be considering those things. And I think as well that it's very much like a skill, right? Like it's a skill that we really have to kind of build, and it can be difficult if you're, you know, in a silo and reflecting on your own. But I think having, like, even for kind of us, like, speaking together and reflecting on these things with one another really helps to kind of bounce those ideas around and to gain, like, a deeper understanding.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Does that does that count as our small talk, Laura?
I think that does. That's why I was just going to seamlessly move in.
One of us always ruins the seamless transition.
Yeah. We're not very seamless.
Should we? Are we people?
Yeah. So I guess kind of, well, off the back of that then, if we have a little bit of a think of about kind of myths of sport performance. So this is the title of Amy and Jen's books, or one of their many books. There we go. I have it as well. Look at it. So
here it is. Pass it across the screen, Christian. You can have it.
So this book came out in 2024. And before we go into a bit of a discussion around kind of what drove kind of your kind of motivation for writing this book or editing this book, I'll just give a quick like synopsis. So the synopsis is, so sport performance is a complex, highly studied, highly debated and often controversial mixture of theories, opinions and evidence. So this book aims to demystify some of the most pervasive myths, misconceptions and realities surrounding the how, what and why of improving sport performance in sport. So guys, what kind of drove you to... yeah, I want to put this book together.
So Myths of Sport Performance is our second book, and Myths of Sport Coaching was first. So I guess to give you the reason why for Myths of Sport Performance, I should take you back to Myths of Sport Coaching. Myths of Sport Coaching was a product of Jen and I working together in coach development. Jen, very much, I see Jen as my on the ground person, working, you know, in the thick of it with coaches, with MDTs in the sporting performance world. I'm in that a little bit, but I'd say I'm more in the academia. And for me, and Jen might have a slightly different kind of motivation for the books, was how do we take all this stuff that we know in academia and we make it really translatable to as many people, coaches, people working in sport as possible? Because I maybe it's my insecurity and my own little hang-up, but sometimes I see that there's this big disconnect between academia and practice on the ground. And there shouldn't be. Like, our job in academia should be about translating knowledge, and I think that gets missed. So for me, that was a big motivation. And Jen and I are seeing these myths crop up. Jen even more so, working, you know, with national governing bodies, people designing coach education, people working in different contexts. So that was a big reason. So Myths of Sport Performance came about because there's so many more myths for us to bust. And you'll see even in Myths of Sport Coaching, it's not just about coaching. Like, I had physiotherapists get in touch with me, athletes get in touch with me, people from outside of coaching be like, these myths are really relevant to my field. So that's kind of why we broadened it to sport performance.
And were there maybe, Jen, like, obviously with your experience kind of on the ground, were there any myths that kind of resonated with you the most that you'd kind of experienced in your own work that was in the book?
Yeah, good question. Yes, and there's kind of an addition to the first book to lead to the answer in the second, was that by the time we got to kind of gathering our subject matter experts and authors and the interest, the commercialization of some of these ideas and the sticky hook or the influential people who had slightly misread or skewed the research for their own benefit meant that actually we could have actually taken some of the original myths, or so the myths of sports coaching ones, and brought them back in again. So there was loads of stuff, loads of ones, more obvious ones from the first book that people were like, yeah, I get it. I can now challenge upwards, use it for a vehicle for conversation, et cetera, et cetera. And then coming to these ones, we were like, do we go vastly different, or do we top up on some of the other ones? How do we keep the language accessible, but we're going broader, and actually some of the disciplines might like the more nitty gritty academic read. They might relate to it. And I do agree. I do agree mostly with the comment that Amy made about academics should try and translate. But I also think there's a laziness and a little bit, I don't know if entitlement is the right word, but there's a laziness coming in with the access to anytime, anywhere learning through TikToks and podcasts, and people going, I listen to a podcast, therefore it is. And you're like, oh, okay. Well, have you thought about
it? Don't even get me started on that.
Yeah, sorry. That's a second podcast we need to record separately, yes. Right? Yeah. So there's something about not saying that this book is the only way and the amazing correct answers in everything. And we're not trying to turn people's worlds upside down, but it was just, you know, the contribution from the webinars of people saying, oh, you never did one on leadership. Oh, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? Oh, what's chapter seven, the myth that being a good mother and an elite athlete are not compatible. Totally relevant to my world at the moment, where we're bringing pregnancy guidelines in and a whole host of postnatal support for the various disciplines within the medical setting for the women's football. So there's topics that were relevant and prevalent now. There was interest from others. But there's also something about the reach of people. So the great people, there's, I don't think there's one, two, maybe four chapters who are written by people on their own, five, and the rest have two, three. So we're like 40 plus authors contributed to this book. So across two books, you've got the bones of 70 people who are deeply passionate about an area, excited to contribute. So you guys know from the contribution in the first chapter, a great exercise to get the best of all these brains and the latest research and debunking or reaffirming or building on these topics, to have something for people to go to that they can check and challenge the norms of whatever's flicking through Instagram. And I'm not saying that in an ignorant way, that that's how coaches are learning solely, but it's an unavoidable now. You know, your time is being marketed by the click in the second. So that's a long way around. And I know I still haven't fully answered it, but there's, I think there's some meatier chapters in this book. There's some ones that have longer titles that maybe have topics, because we're reaching across many disciplines. We have people who are thinking about, you know, there's some more generic titles like the leadership one. There's one on sleep that people would be go straight away, go, oh yeah, okay, I know those topics, I'll dive into those. But I think there's some brilliant nuanced ones in there as well. And there's ones that are really specific that you go, oh, I never thought about that. Or Alex's chapter on smoke and mirrors, little bit of the challenge where we're saying, yes, women have a place in sport and they're doing this. And she's saying, oh, do they? She's highlighting some stats and ruffling some feathers there and giving us the stats, not just her own subjective view. So yeah, there's a load of different chapters in there by, as I said, like 40 plus people on a global reach. We're not just staying in the UK, that really help people go, you've heard this, you've thought about this, you've asked the questions that we've talked about in reflective practice. So where are you with this now?
Mm-hmm. That there's so much to unpack there.
When I made the comment about connecting like research with people on the ground, what I don't want that to be misinterpreted is we're not dumbing it down. Because Jen's right, like we need to encourage, we want people to read this stuff, but it's more about making it just more accessible, because we do this research, it's stuck behind a paywall half the time in academia. Coaches, psychologists, people that we want to read this work can't actually access it. So like as Jen said, if we can bring all of this work and we can put it in one place and make it like, this is another book, bear in mind, like you see academic textbooks and they're £150. how are we expecting people to read it? I wouldn't buy it.
Mm-mm.
So a big thing for us is about making it accessible and affordable, which we've been really...
Christian, I was going to say, like, Amy and I have had, like... I don't think we've ever had heated debates because we're good communicators and we respect each other. But we've definitely challenged each other when we've read through the chapter. So we read through a chapter, we read through it again. We then divvy off over another kind of editor iteration where I'd say, Amy, I just don't know if this is going to land. Like, they've opened up in real thick, heavy academic language that just I'm not hooked on the first few lines. And she'll say, yeah, but what about this? And that's important to frame that. So even I'm learning and she's learning through the perspective of what we assume the people on the ground that we've spoken to, or the people in academia who are doing these steps of research, trying to find that, you know, nice mismatch there or messy piece.
That makes me laugh, and it's a good point. And this isn't what like I want to like unpick, but it makes me laugh because I don't know if it's like my autism, but my writing can be so like, I don't know, upfront academic. And sometimes I have to use ChatGPT to make it sound more human.
Oh, wicked.
Yes.
That's amazing.
And I have to use a computer to make me sound more personable when I'm doing like book chapters instead of like articles. So I just thought it's so funny. I told my mom that, and she's like, wait, you have to use a computer to make you sound more human? I was like, yeah, this should not surprise you at all. But there's so many things to unpack there. So firstly, going to kind of that easy access to information, me and Laura have talked about loads of times. It's a big point of frustration for me, I think, with the way the world has gone in terms of lack of critical thinking and lack of critical thinking training for more just like the general population, leading to a lot of the problems we have at the moment. And a lot of that is access to this easy information that is just fake information. And so I think that's it. But that's also made worse by, like you mentioned, Amy, the paywall that a lot of this academic work is behind. So for those of you who don't know, these, you know, a lot of the book companies really rack up their book prices because they're going to be bought by universities. And also every article that we write and we submit to a journal is what, about like $30, something like that, to buy if you're not with an institution that has access to it. So the access to all this research that people are doing is behind a paywall that I wouldn't, if I weren't part of, you know, a university, I'm not paying $30 per article. So I think that, and this is why it's like amazing to have you guys on, because it's so congruent with what we're trying to do, is make information more accessible and relatable to people. So that's just something I wanted to say, is just like just pointing out how important it is to get all this information out there written by various different people in ways that you guys think will be best used on the ground. So I don't know if you want to, I've got a couple other things I want to dig into what you said, but I'll give you guys some space to chat if you want, instead of taking over everything.
So going back to the social media and quick information, this is something I spoke recently about with someone, because, and we ran a nutrition public seminar last night with the giant store, and this was a big topic as well, because nutrition is just full of myths, like don't eat sugar, don't eat too many carbohydrates, have a high protein diet. And I do think like Instagram or other social media platforms plays a huge role in creating these myths, especially when, again, like why I have to check myself, well, I have access to a nutritionist and a biomechanist and a physiologist, but I spoke to someone this morning who was interested in a certain type of diet, and in the back of my head I'm thinking maybe that's not the right thing to do, but like it's not her fault, she hasn't got direct access to all of these things. So I think that's why we created the book. But what I'd be against, like if someone said to me, can you create me a 60 second not even 60 seconds, that's too long for Instagram, isn't it? Like 10 seconds, like a post about each one of these chapters. I've said no, because you need to get into the meat of it, you need to know the history of it. I think that's a lot of these chapters. And I will say there is a YouTube link where you can listen to an overview of the chapters from the chapter authors, but we're not doing that these topic areas justice, if we're, you know, there was an article recently about, was it some different seed oils get cause cancer, and actually so that's become really big, and one of my nutrition colleagues read the paper where that come from. It doesn't even say that. Like, one of the big papers of taking that, misinterpreted it, posted it on in the headline newspaper, and now half the world thinks that they shouldn't have seed oil. So that is a prime example of how these myths come about.
I was bringing it back to some of the stuff in the first book, and definitely some of the stuff that were some of the chapters in the second book. There's a really good example of, for say, the 10,000 hours, and how that unraveled over time, and how people latched onto different parts that were useful, or the learning styles piece. But there's also something in key influencers on podcasts now, just bringing people in or themselves doing something, and because they're sharing it, everybody's latched onto that. And then those people have a bit of a platform. So they're releasing a book, and then you're going, oh, I must buy the book. And I mean, I'm on regular weekly conversations with people who are saying, oh, I did this and I'm doing that and I'm going there. Or when, even on a real simple example, when Small Sided Games came out, people were like, oh, yeah, with Small Sided Games. Now, I used to work across a number of different schools in London at the time. And I was hearing the teachers say, oh, just play games. So then you literally had the literal translation with either for whatever reason, like a support or education or whatever it was, just doing that in the PE sessions, in the after school sessions. And I was working with the senior leaders at the time in the school to try and develop this whole curriculum. And I thought to myself, gosh, this is really interesting. I wonder how this is going to evolve, because that's not what was meant. But, then you look at some of the, I was fortunate enough then to be working across a couple of different Olympic sports who had seen 5 or 6 years later, the under 16s had come in from environments that had been practicing this just play. And there was a complete different caliber, or lack of skill, or lacking in certain areas that they'd noticed as international coaches, from club coaches just not able to process and interpret this this term, and how it can unravel. So
that's so interesting. It's like a game of telephone, and you guys have that here, right? Or in the UK. I'm not like throwing some random
term. I'm not sure what that means.
It's like when you didn't, like in school, you would all get in a circle, and then one person would whisper something into that person's ear, and then by the time it got back to that same person, it would be like a completely different sentence. And it just like feels like that to me. Like, here's what's meant by whoever has this expertise, and then it gets filtered through various social media sites or types of interpretations, and then these interpretations can be wrong, you know, almost on purpose sometimes for people's gain, or just lack of understanding, and that's no one's fault, but it gets spread so fast, and it's like a global game of telephone that's just really frustrating to deal with on the ground. So that's crazy that you noticed such a difference from this I guess game of telephone. And then something else I just wanted to, that's still stuck in my head since you said it. Did you say they're just bringing in pregnancy guidelines for completely tangential change, but it's been stuck in my head. They're just bringing in pregnancy guidelines for women's football.
Yeah, we're actually kind of world leading on it.
That's amazing. That's firstly amazing that you're world leading, but crazy that we're recording this in 2024, that's world leading. And I'm so glad that you're doing that. So would you provide a little bit of context for about the league and what you guys are doing, and
so
any tangents?
So about, what's that span? Let's say it's, a few years, 4 or 5 years. There was a big exercise done on just understanding the landscape around female athlete health in general. And then there were some really key areas, as we're all probably really familiar with, that are now probably part of more regular conversations. And we then started to support around education. So there's a course called Football Her that all clubs have access to, a number of different licenses to understand key areas like pelvic health, menstrual cycle, key areas around female athlete health. And then every club in the Women's Super League and Championship have a female athlete health lead who has gone on a course who with the Well HQ and with the Women's Pro League or Professional Leagues. So this kind of partnership to create a bespoke strategy, support system, wraparound that they can then ripple into the environment. And that plays a key part in my role around the wider performance well-being as a physical well-being piece. And there's more work being done around Red S, endometriosis, sleep that contributes. But it was a really valuable and eye-opening piece of work that said, hey, do you know that this is possibly happening? We don't have a lot of players who are having children and returning or even confidently able to have this conversation with the club. And at the time, it was because each club is its kind of own entity as well. You're kind of saying, well, listen, you can come to us for a little bit of guidance, but how are you running it? And it's now formalized into, here's a really robust, how many pages in, sort of 50? It's anyway, 26 or 50. I'll have a quick look at it. There's been so many iterations of it, but it's a really robust document. There's also a number of other ones that have been produced this year that just say from start to finish, pre and postnatal, this is what you should consider. This is from a multidisciplinary perspective, bringing in the sports psychs, how we might build on kind of the government and societal pieces around just maternity in general. And what does the layer of performance add to this? And, I had the fortune of being part of a club that were so open to this conversation, so supportive that, you know, two of the players when I was in post were able to have a conversation, go and have a baby, have the experience of being pregnant in whatever country that worked for them, stay connected with the team because it was a whole plan, and then return and come back into the team. And wow. Now she's had a second baby, and so that's happened again. And there's, you know, clubs now speaking to each other. There's players feeling more confident to have this conversation. There's facility guidance in there that says this is what you should have if you're breastfeeding, et cetera, et cetera. There was a meeting we had the other day with a club who have a player returning who has spoken to their sponsor, and the sponsor is making bespoke gear so that there's a mechanism in the tops for her to breastfeed and still be on brand. So there's a whole load of different things happening, some more structured and around the kind of physiological needs and considerations. There's a whole psychological piece around the language and behaviours associating, and the kind of return to play, return to play as a mother, a new mother, you know, whatever the case may be. And then there's more work linked to the FA being done on same-sex couples' journey, so that there, if you are the partner of, or that there is a whole host of experiences that mother might go through on a journey, that everybody in the environment within reason and acceptance would understand that this isn't the same as a kind of heterosexual couple and what they might go through. And not saying that one is more important than the other, but there's different needs. So there's a really robust document that's we're really proud of, but it is something that players and practitioners can be more informed to support kind of the growth of that environment and needed.
That just made me so happy to hear all the details of it. It links into some of the research that Laura, Amy and I have done on the sexism. I mean, we did it on people working in sport, but like you said, lack of kit facilities that are very specific to women, often go unmet. And obviously this is happening recently because of the structural barriers in place that you couldn't even put this in place for women potentially, you know, 5-10 years ago. So it's amazing you guys are able to do this. But I guess it almost points to your chapter on the smoke and mirrors. Like, we think that women in sport are so, you know, equal and stuff like that, but women are just now getting pregnancy protections and kit that maybe facilitates breastfeeding and more understanding of, you know, various types of needs. So I think it just all, like, all these myths chapters fit so well into what's actually happening, like on the ground, like what you guys are saying.
Just on that chapter, Amy, definitely I'll let you come in then. The extra layer, I think, of richness in Alex's chapter is that Alex is based in Australia. And so there's a whole, like, she started writing the chapter post World Cup, where they hosted, obviously. So there is something around the not just the topics and kind of subheadings that are covered in there, but the perspective of, we saw big numbers, we saw a massive shift in following, we saw societal and equitable changes, hopefully an influence happening, but actually what's underneath it and how long is that, you know, what's the sustainability piece around that? And, you know, is it a tiny move and should we be grateful, or actually, you know, and wait our turn for more to happen? So, yeah, it's just, it's really nice, really refreshing.
Problem is that we are seeing like things starting to happen, but it doesn't mean, you know, there's an, that we're equal, or there's and I think that's the misconception, isn't it, that like people will say, and I've even said it, oh, have you seen how many like fans we're getting now for like the Women's Super League, and you know, Arsenal are playing in the main like stadium, and yeah, that's great, but that's like one or two examples, but the, you know, the revenue and the tick, like the financial input is still crazy. I don't know if you guys watched I think it was the Hope Solo documentary on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, it's amazing. So she was really I don't know, like I'm only going off what she was saying in the program, but she was talking about how she got shunned from the women's game in America because she was trying to challenge the federation. Because even though the women's team were generating much more money, like millions and millions of more money than the men, the investment in the men's game was through the roof compared to how much the women got paid and supported. And if you look at soccer in America, like women are like absolutely outperforming the men. Yet the men were still getting way more money and investment. So that for me is a really good example of, yeah, like visually, that sport, women are getting, you know, doing well, getting loads of fan support. But underneath that, it's very, very unequal. And I think, so I guess that's the point. And Kristen, I always think back to when you and I delivered a session for our master's students around sexism and working in sport, and the like lovely, really like kind of open-minded males in the room, and I put the hand up and said, but this isn't an issue anymore, because women look at women's football, and you're like, well, yeah, look at it, it's developing, but it's nowhere near at the same level as the men in terms of support and like, you know, TV time and finances and funding and everything else.
And that brings up two things for me, like that example. So number one, yeah, it's important to acknowledge how far you've come, but without saying, okay, we can stop now. You know, I'll get, you know, people of a certain generation, like, you guys should just be happy because it was so much worse for us. Like, no, that's not what progress is about. And then number two, with that example, these questions and comments came after an hour of us presenting like data from over 100 women telling them that it was still happening. And so I think that, like, obviously that cognitive dissonance between learning that this is still happening and then understanding that it's still happening is still huge, especially for men who like see what they want. It's almost like that confirmation bias. Like, I see that what, you know, this is, it's what sort I'm looking for. There's always one word I can't figure out that I'm trying to say in the podcast. It's more convenient. It's more convenient for me to see that there's this progress because it's too uncomfortable to address the truth of what actually is happening. And then there's just not access to that information as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like this is something that like the book is really good at doing. It is kind of really digging into the nuances, but then also what might be a little bit uncomfortable for people to actually look at and realize, and challenging those beliefs. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I tell you a story I had the weekend with my dad?
Please do.
So, where I'm from, they had a lot of like working men's clubs, so women were not allowed. And it was probably only till like very recently that women are allowed. And so there's, in these clubs, they had snooker like rooms, and again, women were not allowed in the snooker rooms. So my wife was like she couldn't, she's a man was blown because she was like, what is a working man's club there? And he was like, well, you know, it's a club that only men can access because, you know, when a man's on a hard day's work, he needs a space to go, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, but what would happen if a woman entered that space? Like, she was like, just couldn't get her head around it. And then, so anyway, but he's like, well, Michelle, there's no problem anymore because women are allowed in there now. Like, so that's it, problem solved.
Oh, my gosh.
For him, problem solved, yeah. Problem yeah. Over. And I think that is just a perfect example of where, like you were saying, because women are now of, like, they think that just allowing, given access is solved all the issues, and we should be happy that we've now got access.
And, it, like, that's such a good example because a month ago, it was the 50-year anniversary of women being allowed to get bank accounts. I can't remember if it was the States or the U.S. And so you think, okay, well, women are allowed to have bank accounts now. Problem solved. Like, same idea. But then we're actually seeing that first generational impact of what the long-term impact of women not having it looks like. And so that, you know, looks like things like divorce rates going up because women have freedom to leave unhappy or bad marriages, like less kids, things like that, because women are allowed to work and there's no cover for maternity in a lot of places. And so it makes me wonder, like, what the longer term impacts of just like that club alone, what smaller changes in people's lives locally would that have made if, you know, women were allowed in after work as well?
Wonder why. And then he'll make a comment that men are better at snooker than women, for example, and I'll say, but women are only allowed to practice like x number of years ago, so women of your age have had half as much practice as you. And then he'll go, oh, okay, all right.
At least he does that.
Yeah.
This might be a good time to almost transition into the women's stories book, unless you guys have anything more specific that you want to talk about for the myths book before we move on. Was there anything we didn't touch on? Okay, no. Cool. We tend to go on tangents and then lose track of time, so I want to make sure that we're fitting everything in. This book sounds awesome. It's called Women Working in Sport, See Them, Hear Them, Be Them, and it's coming out this year, right? In 2025? Awesome.
Women's Day on the 8th of March.
Oh, amazing.
Oh, nice.
Cool. I mean, we're happy about that, but I mean, Women's Day in itself, don't get me started on that.
Yeah.
Women's Day, Women's Week. Wow.
My favorite, it's a stat on International Women's Day that the number one search thing on that day is, when is International Men's Day? Because all these men online are complaining about not having one. It's sometime in November. Like,
so
come on,
I saw like a tweet on that, and then a woman had replied, like, it hasn't happened because a woman hasn't organized
yes,
it.
Yes. Yeah. Like, oh, were you expecting a parade? There isn't one because there wasn't a woman to organize it for you.
Yeah.
So because the book's not online yet, we don't have a synopsis like we do for your myths book. Books. Plural. So do you guys want to give like a quick summary of what the book looks like?
Yeah, sure.
Aim, I
suppose.
Do you
want me to do that?
This is Jen's mastermind, so I'll let Jen.
It's probably just under 2 years now, which is a really long time, but it's so rich it's worth waiting for. So I sent Amy a message and said, I think we were across so many groups and we work with so many incredible women, so many incredible people that were like, how do we continue to influence change, not just tell a nice story? So I had a chat with Amy and then emailed the publisher, and within, oh, I don't know, 7 seconds, I had a reply back. And he's like, yeah, do it. Let's go. Just do it now.
Amazing.
Go. So that was brilliant to get his backing. And since then we just, I was going to, what's the right way to phrase it? We didn't access people. Like, we invited incredible women to write a chapter. Why I feel uncomfortable about that is that it's only 20 people. I think it's just on the cusp of that. We had a couple of people change, but there's so many more people, and there's so many books that we have read that tell great stories, stories of resilience and aspiration and motivation. But we wanted this to also have an angle or a parallel kind of process to support organisations, governing bodies, even individuals within influential roles to pick the book up or at least have a conversation, like the others have been vehicles for change and conversation, and then to think for a second, ah, okay. And that is, you know, so the starting point was to go and have a conversation with people that we knew were in roles that had maybe challenged their way to the top, or, and it wasn't a case of asking people to give us warts and all. It wasn't a tell us all the horrible things that have happened to you. But we framed some loose questions to say, this is what we were thinking about in a chapter, because they are living and breathing everyday life. It wasn't, there's no kind of heavy academic or underpin like the other books. That was the learning curve, definitely for me and possibly for Amy on that, to say, right, God, there's so much richness in here. How can we edit and critique somebody's story? And what do we shape it into? Because it needs to be what it is, but we need to have a purpose where we're not just saying, have a look at these amazing stories, you know, see it, be it from that angle, but we want to influence change. And my goodness, like the stories, the pathways, the courage, the creativity, like you name it, all those adjectives and more that people have shared with us in this book will make for not just great stories, but this, and I do hate this word, but I'm going to use it for reference, this allyship that they have experienced, that they have found supportive and useful, has really created windows. I mean, Kristen, you've been instrumental in your contribution to the book as well. So there's a whole host of brilliance in the book. And then you have people who are mentioned within the book that can be part of this influence, that say, actually, instead of being a barrier, they were a person who left the ladder down, or whatever analogy you might use. But there is one thing that's in it that isn't a spoiler, but it's a thread, as there have been in the other books. There's a thread where at one point where we say, or we hear, you know, don't enter a job that doesn't align with your values. You're talking about people who have had their values challenged on a regular basis, but they make a decision to persevere to a certain point to keep that kind of elephant path or whatever, you know, going, and create a space for people to follow through. Because if they left that job at that point, that would close the door. They didn't survive it. They weren't good enough. They're not the right fit. So that's the part for me that was like almost a poignant moment reading through some of the chapters, having endless Zoom calls and Teams calls with people to understand and to support them in navigating their thoughts and putting pen to paper, was, gosh, like, this is really hard to hear them do that. And you have a whole range of what they've experienced and endured. And some are able to share and some are not able to share. But in how they've explained, you kind of get the feel of it. So I press pause there, but I don't know if there's missing from that.
There's so many things I want to unpack there, unless you want to say something first, Amy, about it. Laura.
It's just a follow on from what Jen was saying. Like, one of us, sorry, Laura. I'll cut you off there.
You go, then I'll go.
Okay. And like Jen said, like, even like every person that I tell that we created this book and it's inspirational women, and then I'm probably talking to an inspirational woman in front of me, and then I'm like, oh, like, of course I would want to. I want to invite every woman that I work with to contribute to the book. Like, one of my colleagues the other day was like, I can't believe I didn't get an invite to contribute.
Oh, really?
Oh, no.
But we won. It didn't want to be just all of Jen and our friends. So that we had to be careful of that. And two, we wanted it to be representative as much as we could, like from a global perspective. So we've got people from India, Brazil, Norway, Canada. And we wanted to try, so we've probably fallen short in a million areas, but we wanted to try as much as we could to bring in cultural like nuances, and we wanted to make sure we were capturing people from with different ethnic and cultural backgrounds, because like we didn't want it to just be a UK-centric book of women working in sport, because I appreciate that. I think we're quite more fortunate than maybe other countries or kind of cultures, so that was something that we were quite passionate to do. Mm-hmm. So yeah, to all the people listening who were like, why weren't we invited?
That's what I was just thinking, Amy.
But Laura, surprise, you're going to be in the second edition.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
And people from different professions as well. So obviously we could have a whole book on inspirational female sports psychologists or coach developers, but we've got people working in coaching and people in academia, people working in disability sport. We've got one of the first female female coaches, basketball coaches. And we've got people working in leaders in sports or leadership positions. So we wanted as much as we could to try and showcase different types of careers, because for me, I thought, how cool would it be as a 17, 18 year old thinking, I want to go and work in sport, but I'm not really sure. And it's a little bit intimidating in some of these environments. And I can read a book and I can say, look, this woman's been successful in these ways and this woman's been successful in these ways. And these are almost preempt some of the hurdles that they might come across, but they can see how other people have overcome them.
And I think as well, thinking about maybe the books or kind of literature that was available when I was going through training, Kristen was going through training, it is a lot of kind of men's experiences of being in these environments. I know. And I think that what he's saying here is getting people to pick up the book and to be able to resonate with something or at least one of the stories in it. And I think that's how I felt when you were talking about one of the stories just before around this idea of kind of being in a male dominated environment, maybe noticing that you don't quite fit, that it doesn't quite work with your values, but forcing yourself to continue because you don't want to think that you failed or that you've kind of not been able to figure it out. That was one of my big things when I stopped working in football, was if I stop working here, I'm telling myself that I haven't been able to figure out how to be successful in this environment. I think that was a really difficult thing for me to let go of and kind of accept and move on from. So I think if I had stories like that which I could resonate with, then I think it would have helped me a lot in understanding my experiences, but also making some of those decisions that were ultimately better for me and my life in the long run.
But there's some of the chapters and a pattern across probably 50% of the book of people who have only done that for a period of time. So they have been thinking about their mental health, they have had a plan, they're bringing other people on a journey. So there's, beyond, N equals one. So there's a few more experiencing it and they're building a team and then they leave. So there is, there's that little bit of, can you get to a point where you're, you finish a project or you get to the end of a season and then you say, what are my options and how do I move through? But there's very few people in the book who are in jobs for a really long time. And part of that is the experiences they've had. And Amy and I wrote a chapter each as well. And that was a really interesting, I probably did five different angles, really interesting experience. I didn't want to do it. And part of that was probably revisiting some of the experiences that as a thick skinned Irish woman, I'm like, I should be grand. Just get in there now, put your head down and just, you're lucky to have a job. Would you go on? And, there was one team I worked with, there were 26 backroom staff and I was the only female. And variations of that over the years that maybe when I was in the middle, I was just super grateful to have that position. So I would have accepted any of language and behaviour that came the way to a certain extent. But so there's loads of different examples that I share in there that I think, oh God, okay, maybe they would be helpful, or I shouldn't have done that, or that's not acceptable. And why wasn't I aware at the time? So hopefully we'll build over the years with this book, and maybe there'll be future ones for people to say what you've said there, Laura, that's a little bit of okay.
Yeah, and I think that awareness part is so important, because I think something that we talk about quite a lot, right, is that and I think especially for me, early on, working in sport, I wasn't sure what, say, sexism even looked like. I just kind of thought that these were kind of normal behaviours. This is just what it's like to work in one of these environments. So I think even having that a bit of awareness and being able to check ourselves, questioning, oh, is that okay? Like, do I accept that? Do I tolerate that? Or actually, do I need to try and push back on it or do something about it?
This is probably really unsurprising, but I have a lot to say.
I can see you like, come on, let me go. Oh,
switching in the background. Okay, so yeah, Laura and I talk about this all the time, like what is acceptable, and you only learn what's more and more acceptable as you gain more experience, but then there's this massive barrier to gaining more experience because the longer you're in these environments, your mental health can start to really suffer. And it really touches on what you guys are talking about in terms of like, oh, well, if my values don't align, I just leave. Well, that doesn't really work in a lot of performance environments. And then at the same time, it's like, okay, well, we do need some women to stay in and kind of forge that path. But then how much of that burden do we want to put on women to put themselves through that? So it's almost like this vicious, vicious cycle. And you see so many women going, okay, 1 to 5 years, and then I'm out because for whatever reason. And when we were talking initially about like me doing a chapter for the book, I know that you guys were really, what's the word I'm looking for? Like sympathetic, but like just like aware of the burden that's often put on women to tell their stories and overcome these barriers that are not their fault. And so I think that also goes along to why you guys were very careful about who you were asking, the when, the why, the how, as obviously you guys wanted a lot of diversity of experience and people, but at the same time, it's like, okay, well, we know that when we're looking at data for women, the burden is put on women to work even harder. So you guys were quite sensitive about that. But that also goes into, sorry, I hope this all makes sense. Like what you guys were saying about, well, there's not that much written for women by women. So Laura and Amy will know from being my supervisors when I was training that there is a specific book that I mentioned in a lot of my reflections that I went based off of my initial sports psych training. And a lot of it says like you basically don't want to be portrayed as too much of a psychologist because that's a feminine trait and being feminine in football is bad. And I took advice from that going, okay, I need to minimize my femininity to fit in this environment. And if I would have had a book that said, no, that's not the case, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Then that would have been so much more productive and I would have developed better, maybe quicker in a way that was more in line with where I wanted to be. So I think that, you know, books written for women by women are incredibly important. And I also know what you mean, Jen, about, you know, some of these concepts generating what I like to term a lot on this podcast, feminine rage. because even when I was doing the one chapter, it was around when the Harrison, you guys know the Harrison Butker. I know you and Jen and I talked about it. Do you remember the Harrison Butker speech that, okay, Amy no. and Laura are saying no. So essentially, this was like back in May, and this NFL player, he's just like a kicker. He doesn't really do that much.
Wow.
Whoa.
Reduction.
I don't have
to. Paid a lot of money, kicks a ball.
Yeah, he just kicks a ball one time. That's all, and then he runs away. He can't even be tackled or anything. But he went to this women's college. It was a religious college, and basically said, your degrees, well done, but get back in the kitchen, essentially. Like, that's where your real true role was. And so that really, I think, like, fueled a lot of my, like, some of my examples in the chapter. And just writing about the historical suppression of women's stories is just so frustrating. And that's why this book is even more important. Just, you know, let's really value and express women's stories. And so to end my little rant, I suppose, I just wanted to pick up on what Jen said at the beginning about the issue with the term ally, because I think we might have talked about this before, agree with that, like with the terminology surrounding ally, because that almost assumes that it's not just treating person like they're a human being. So yeah, the end.
Yeah.
You guys can. Yay!
There's one chapter. Well, there's many chapters in the book, but there's a chapter.
There's more than one chapter in the book.
Yes, Jen, are you okay if I like name some of the people?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Shikiba, who did a chapter for us, she originally is from Iran, and she had to flee Iran when she was a child to, and then came to the UK. She's a sports psychology practitioner and an academic now, but her, I think for me, one of the things about the book is making us aware of some of these real inequalities, not just, you know, we talk about inequalities in the UK, but wider globally. And she tells a story about like how her and her twin sister got serious repercussions as a child for playing tag in the playground, because I'm assuming, like, you know, young girls shouldn't be running and playing. And so that, like, literally the opening couple paragraphs of that chapter, and I'm just like, you know, wow. That is a prime example where women are second class citizens.
There's something on the back of what both of you have just said there as well. I think it's important to maybe bring to the surface is we have to keep mentioning and keep doing this. And I know, Kristen, you're saying like it is a responsibility, and we were really cognizant of that going into it, to say, listen, endless Zoom calls if you need it. If we're opening, you know, some doors and emotions that you haven't done in a while, but you want to, then if it's beyond our remit, we will provide or get support for you to feel supported, because at the end of the day, it's only a book and only a chapter, and your life is your life that you're living. So you are the most important. This is the role the book will play. Your chapter will be a core part of it, et cetera, et cetera. And we have incredible books like The Authority Gap and Invisible Women that have gone stat, 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 stat. Realize the carnage that has been created before you. But this is a different, you know, it's a different kind of lens again, but we are building on that, as you say, Christian, like, for women, by women, and this message and this narrative, where the language and experiences, without even thinking, for some of the authors, their examples are completely and immediately relatable, even if it's a tiny little aspect. So that we were, that was part of the journey. And I'm even reading a book this morning. Is it Good for a Girl? Lauren Fleshman's book. I started reading that the other day. A collegiate athlete talking about, you know, being an athlete and running in a man's world. So, but she doesn't do it in the same way as the other books I've read. So there's other angles of something will land in this book with the amount of chapters we have and the different jobs and different journeys they've been on. We hope that they'll not just be the individual story that will be a motivator and an inspiring, amazing journey, but there'll also be something to have a conversation with somebody who's, you know, in an influential position in an organisation that can start to make some change, you know.
And maybe on that, and I guess as we're thinking about, I guess, kind of like creating change through this awareness, we have, of course, some reflections for us all to kind of have a think about off the back of this conversation with Jen and Amy. So first reflection that we think might be useful is thinking about, like, what information about sport or performance have you heard, maybe on social media or in the press, that might actually be a bit of a myth? So what are maybe some of the things that you've been seeing a lot whilst you've been like scrolling, and maybe thinking about kind of checking what might be behind that information? And then secondly, just reflecting on whether kind of any of these women's experiences that we've been talking about have surprised you.
Laura has such a good voice for the reflections, so that's why she always does them, because it's very relaxing and makes you think. But thank you guys so much for coming on the podcast. I know it's so busy for both of you, so we really appreciate you guys coming on and talking about your books.
Yeah, thank you.
And your experiences as a whole. And we're going to be begging you to come back at some point, so get ready for those emails.
Yes, we will. Thanks a million. What a great conversation. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a great always love talking to you guys. And I know we could probably get on 800 more different tangents, which is always an issue. But where can people find the books?
Yes. The Myths of Sports Performance book will be on the Sequoia, the publisher's website, and then Amazon. They're the awesome. Amazon, and to the points we made earlier, we wanted this to be accessible in language and affordable. So there's always, you know, a percentage off it. There's some student discounts that we have some codes for as well. that knock 25-30% off. So, and then there's bulk buy, you know, 40% deals off. If I think we've had a couple of NBA teams buy a bulk of 15 or 20 of them. So there's lots of different offers to make it, because it was never about making the money part of it for us at all.
Awesome. Thank you. And then where can they find you on their socials? I know that I'll put it in the show notes, but are there any social medias you want to chuck out there for those listening?
Probably just like LinkedIn and X for me, but maybe I won't be on X for much longer.
Yeah,
I feel you on that.
Yeah, I'm transitioning. Yeah. It's blue sky now, isn't it?
Okay, I need to move with the times.
Yeah, I've heard that's much kinder than X, and you're not getting constant Elon Musk
influences. Yeah, so yeah. Maybe LinkedIn is
LinkedIn.
Best,
I think for me too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, we'll put all that information in the show notes. But thanks everyone for listening. As usual, we probably have more questions than answers, but we really enjoyed exploring the myths of sport performance and stories of women in sport. Did this leave you with any questions? Make sure to comment and let us know. We'd also love to know if you have... Sorry, my dog is literally whining in the background. we'd love to know if anyone has any topics that you'd like us to explore. So please get in touch. Make sure to like, follow, engage however your platform allows, and tell your friends. You can find us on various social media platforms, and we'll also stick. Oh my God, can't talk anymore. I'm so distracted by the job. We will stick those socials in the show notes as well. And remember, the first step to understanding is asking, but why?